this time, Big Sam's Bolton, back in the big time. Welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a podcast in which football fans attempt the seemingly impossible to rank once and for all who is the greatest team of all time. My name's Graham Dunn, making the case for Oxford United at every opportunity, and our king of the data, as ever, it's Jamie Rooney.
Not always, as ever, as we may find out. But yeah, Bolton Wanderers, no income tax, no VAT, no Premier League guaranteed. The Trotters, fantastic. The Trotters from the North.
Very good. Yes, this is should be a cracking side. Bolton and Big Sam's Bolton are a team we've been keen to do for a fair while, Jeremy.
Before we get into it, I just want to shine a light on our brilliant foresight that we clearly have doing these things, because there's a film that's been released in the last month or two called Copper 71. It's a football related film, and it's about the young women that went and participated in Italy and Mexico in 1970 1971, particularly in Mexico, for the unofficial World Cup, which Denmark won both versions. And we covered that Denmark team, that very Denmark team, last July in our pre-season friendlies, Graham.
I had temporarily forgotten that we'd actually covered that side, mostly because a lot of the coverage around it was around the England team. So I thought, no, we didn't do England 70-71. I don't know what that is, until you pointed out, no, it's about the Denmark team.
It was the Denmark team, yeah, that brilliant Denmark team that won the first two unofficial editions of the Women's World Cup.
So we're talking about Bolton Wanderers. I should hold my hand up before we get stuck into it. In the trail for this podcast, last time out, I talked about Christophe Dugarry, and not I got my mysterious French superstars playing for an unlikely English football league side beginning with a B mixed up. So Christophe Dugarry was for Birmingham, of course, and I meant Jock IF, who goes on to become a star for Bolton, but we'll cover that. And helping us to cover it this week, we have gone to our sort of, I suppose you've become our unofficial Northwest correspondent. Welcome back, Declan Clark.
Good evening, chaps. Nice to be back again. Yeah, unofficial Northwest correspondent.
Well, we're making the most of having a Northwest specialist on to help us. As you know, we've done this on a few occasions. We're trying to build our map of regional ITV football programs, which, of course, this is comes off the back of Big Match, and it's a segment. If this was a radio show, the segment would be called "Who is Brian Moore?" And this is based, it was Phil Craig who pointed out, so it's Phil Craig over on the Northeast who said, I just didn't know who Brian Moore was. We didn't have Brian Moore. And of course, this set me thinking that back in the days of the different ITV regional programs, there was different personalities, different programs. Now, I did a little bit of hunting out for Granada. Now, the program I found, which, by the way, has a series of absolutely fantastic theme tunes from Granada across the years, was Kickoff. Although, Declan, that wasn't the Sunday program, was it?
On the Sunday, we'd have, as you said, we'd have the local match, like football, as it was called. But then we'd get something from, some highlights from whatever was on ATV. Hugh Johns would have been doing that, or something like that. Or from Yorkshire, we'd have Keith Macklin doing it. And then we would get one from the Big Match, so we'd have a bit of Brian Moore as well.
The great thing about the Granada era, that had, I guess, Jerry Sinstak was the first kind of star or TV host in that region, wasn't he?
I don't think it was the first, but I think he was, from my era, Jerry Sinstad was the main man when I was a kid.
In that region, Jamie, who would have been on Footballs? I just love the imagination of that name.
So who was on? So between 68 and 83, 1968 and 1983, when the programme Football was running on Granada TV in the Northwest, surprisingly, out on top with 101 appearances is Manchester City. I mean, they were kicking around in the lower leagues, weren't they? And then after that, you've got Manchester United on 89, Liverpool on 88, and then Dex, Everton, your beloved Everton, coming fourth with 73 appearances. So statistically in Granada, most people were watching Manchester City. I mean, it's come full circle, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they were the decent team for the start of the late 60s, start of the 70s, and then obviously they spent the latter part of the 70s in the doldrums, didn't they?
One of the other themes that we've been looking at over these past couple of things you mentioned on the last pod was around songs that teams come out to when they come out onto the pitch. I enjoy this, obviously, Bolton Wanderers. I couldn't help but notice, having sadly watched Bolton humiliate Oxford on the TV a couple of weeks ago, they come out to a version of The Wanderer, which of course makes some sense, doesn't it? That's quite a logical one for them. And I went to watch Morecambe play 2 weeks ago. Why wouldn't I go to watch Morecambe v Gillingham? And it's another song they come out to. It's the penultimate song they come out to. The one, I think they decided it just wouldn't get people quite in the mood. But of course, what else would they come out to? But Morecambe, Eric Morecambe, Bring Me Sunshine. Now, that's a highly impressive, highly impressive song to come out to. Declan, your team, Everton, Zed Cars. Is there still Zed Cars?
It's still Zed Cars. It's absolutely sacrosanct. Anyone trying to change that, they'll get lynched, frankly. The last person who tried to change that was Mike Walker.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
That's true.
Oh, that's too good.
He had us coming out to the theme tune from 2001, A Space Odyssey, and we went, nah, no.
Or Space Oddity, that would be even better.
Well, the thing is, every time they played it, we lost, and then they reinstated it, and we won. Funny that, isn't it?
Was there a connection for why Zed Cars in the first place?
I don't know exactly. I mean, the theme tune comes from an old sea shanty, an old folk song called Johnny Todd, and that was sort of rearranged by a fellow called, I think it was called Fritz Spiegel, who basically, that was adopted as the theme tune for the TV show, which was based in a place called Newtown, but was effectively Kirby, and it just sort of came from there.
Now, you see, that would make some logic. It doesn't explain why Watford come out to Zed Cars.
No, I never got that one either. Imitation being the sincerest form of flattery, I guess.
Right. That's enough of this. We should get stuck into Big Sam's Bolton Wanderers. I don't think Sam Allardyce would be belittling his achievements at the club. He's not one for... I think he probably suspects that the football world doesn't pay him the respect that he necessarily deserves. It's certainly quite an achievement what he does do at Bolton Wanderers. And, Jamie, they were, you know, a club with a rich reputation and history, but they've been a bit down on the luck, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, they've been around since the 1870s. They're one of the founding members of the English Football League, one of the 12 founding members. And they've had a bit of a yo-yo existence. Famous team in the 1950s, where they picked up a few FA Cups. The last of their four FA Cups was won, I think, in the late 1950s. But other than that, they haven't enjoyed massive amount of success, but they have that fame and notoriety because they had such great players like Nat Lofthouse that represented them and obviously went on and did so well for England. But the fortunes really do begin to shift once Sam Allardyce comes in and levels his ambition at the club and takes them to the heights, the dizzy heights that they've never seen previously.
And that journey, I guess, that journey almost begins with Bruce Rioch. It's under Rioch that Bolton returned to the Premier League, I think, for the first time. And I think they have a cup run at the time. So it's not that us isn't taking over a club that hasn't been in the Premier League. But when he arrives at the club, they are sort of mid-table, not really, you know, really struggling to cement themselves as a Premier League side, and they're back in the second tier, and he's got quite a task ahead of him.
He's taken over the side. There has been in and out. They actually, if I recall right, didn't they go down the first time as a result of not beating Everton? Basically, there was a contentious goal. I think Jerry Taggart scored it, and he didn't. The referee said it wasn't a goal, and basically that game ended 0-0. I think we finished 17th that season, and they actually went down after getting beat by Chelsea. Gianluca Vialli, I love him. Thanks, yes. Gianluca. But so they had a little spell. They'd gone down again. Allardyce took them over, and then got them into the playoffs. I think, did he get to the playoffs twice? I think he faltered the first time when he got to the playoffs, and then I think it might have been Blackburn that beat him, actually. I can't recall offhand. But yeah, then they got to the into the playoffs again by finishing, I think it was fourth in that league, was it?
And Sam Allardyce himself, his, you know, he played for Bolton, he played for a series of, I guess Sam Allardyce is probably known as a no-nonsense centre-back, definitely a kind of old-school centre-back, I think.
I think the word is uncompromising that you're struggling for. There was a lovely he was what we'd call a grok, frankly. I mean, he was effective. He was a good stopper, but he had no real ball skills whatsoever. As soon as he got the ball, he'd want to offload it to someone who could actually play. I think it was Dave Bassett said to recall him a ball playing defender, and basically saying if he didn't get the ball, he'd get yours. which pretty much summed him up. And when he got to his managerial career, a lot of people basically instilled a lot of that in his defence. And a lot of people said, you know, long ball team, Sam Allardyce. But there's a bit more to him than that, as I think we're going to explore.
Definitely so. I mean, I think what's quite interesting is one of his earliest managerial jobs is he's at Preston, and he's actually takes over as a caretaker manager at Preston. Obviously decided that Sam Allardyce, I don't know if Big Sam's long ball tactics were in evidence there, but he's obviously not long ball enough, because John Beck, who we covered his unbelievable Cambridge a couple of weeks ago, but it's John Beck, it gets the job over Sam Allardyce. And Allardyce is part of the coaching setup there. He's there for 18 months or so, working with the youth team. There's a quote attributed to him saying that he described John Beck's football as indefensible. So he's obviously putting a bit of daylight between himself there.
Unless he was misquoted and meant undefendable, as in, you know, you can't defend this stuff. Like, you can't defend against it. I don't know. I mean, if it comes to something, if Sam Allardyce is calling your long ball tactics indefensible, then,
It is quite something, isn't it? He does get his big break, and he gets it at Blackpool, does very well at Blackpool, gets them promoted, and that's where he eventually, via a trip to Notts County, he arrives at Bolton. And he takes over from Colin Todd, Jamie, doesn't he?
He does take over from Colin Todd.
So basically the reason Colin Todd went was they were selling Per Fransson, and he resigned in protest.
Like all great managers. Mark Lawrenson, of course, famously resigned after Dean Saunders has sold to Derby in a not dissimilar move. So yes, and Bolton are raising funds. They've obviously moving into the Reebok Stadium. Now I think the Reebok Stadium is the first stadium in England that is built with a sponsor's name attached to it, because it isn't the first stadium to be named after a sponsor, but it didn't exist before a sponsor. I can't think of anyone else that, because the Reebok Stadium was never anything before the Reebok Stadium. It was from the moment that opened in 97, I think it was the Reebok Stadium.
Yeah, that's right. Sunderland tried it with their grounds, and it turned out they couldn't sell the naming rights. They weren't attractive enough, so that's how it became the Stadium of Light. And it was quite strange that all of Sunderland fans were like, oh my God, that shows how small time we are because we haven't sold our naming rights and our crowd to some baby-eating conglomerate or something like that. Do you know what the stadium's called now, by the way?
Isn't it the Bolton University Stadium or something, or the University of Bolton?
It's called the Tough Sheet Stadium. tough sheet indeed.
I mean, if you've got a thick accent, that comes out slightly different, doesn't it?
Yeah, if you're Spanish, perhaps.
That getting the new ground though is something that sort of helps set Bolton on their way as a sort of Premier League club. They are having to sell players around that time to help with the funding of it. But I was quite struck that when the side that Sam Allardyce takes over, one of the things that Big Sam's Bolton has is this kind of United Nations approach, you know, this kind of bringing together just footballers from lots of different countries and parts of the world, but also from not necessarily countries with a great history of football and so forth. So, you know, at the point he arrives, he's already got Jussi Jukkalainen, Good Johnson is there, Carter Gardner is there, Mark Fish is there, Gundy Bergson is there. Lots of these players who, in my mind, are sort of archetypal Big Sam Allardyce's Bolton. And yet, actually, they were there already ahead of his time, weren't they?
They were. And he had people like Dean Holdsworth there as well. You know, he was a decent striker. He had people like Ricardo Gardner. Klaus Jensen was there, he had a great career with Charlton, didn't he, later on? Mm. So, yeah, Newcastle was a great squad. And like one of the players he did have as well, who came through the academy, was Kevin Nolan, who we'll touch on.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about Kevin Nolan, but we'll carry on.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone on that one. There's a few players we can talk about we might have mixed feelings on.
It's quite impressive, the players that were there then. You look at also, as you say, Declan, in that first season, they get to the playoffs, they lose eventually to Ipswich, but they have cup run. That's one of their cup run seasons. So they get, I think, to both the League Cup and the FA Cup semi-final. And this was at a point when seemingly second tier sides or even below seem to be quite regularly getting to the semi-finals or finals of these of the major cup competitions.
Famously, Chesterfield in this particular area as well. They went all the way to the semi-finals and Crawley denied a play. Lower League Sheffield United at the time as well put up a big profile. Yeah, so you're right, Ben. It was a period. Although when you look back at the run that Bolton had in both of the cup competitions, it's an okay run, but it's not super tough. They don't actually face any Premier League opposition in the FA Cup until they meet Charlton Athletic in the quarterfinal. Ida Good Johnson wins it for that one 1-0. Then they face Aston Villa in the semi-final, which they lose on penalties. And in the League Cup, which was called the Werbinson Cup. And I think it's important that we shouldn't forget the sponsorship, because the League Cup changes shape most seasons. You know, the Coca-Cola Cup, the Werbinson Cup, the Milk Cup. It can change its guise.
But they do, they fall at the semi-final hurdle to, slightly surreally, to John Aldridge's Tranmere Rovers.
Yeah, absolutely. Tranmere Rovers at that time were a really decent football team. They were doing really well. I think they were still riding pretty well in the Championship and threatening to break into the Premier League themselves during that period. Declan will know much more about Tranmere Rovers than I would.
Where they were really knocking on the door. They had a few good players playing for them, including Pat Nevin at one point.
Of course they did.
Just amazing.
So it's the next season that Bolton get going. And it's at this sort of stage we're starting to see some of the more familiar names emerging. Good Johnson, actually, who was their kind of star striker in that first season, he does move on. You know, get quite a lot of money for him. But you start seeing, as you say, the arrival of Kevin Nolan starts making the breakthrough. Michael Ricketts, I think, joins around that time. A very significant striker. And I think you've always kind of, with Big Sam Allardyce, I don't know if it's called Big Sam or Sam Allardyce, Allardyce on his side, you always associate them with a big forward. I found it extraordinary that Kevin Davis hadn't always played there. I mean, Kevin Davies doesn't, who I think is probably the most Bolton player of that big Sam era that I can think of, doesn't actually join for several years. They do have some of the these kind of players who are going to become important for them. Michael Ricketts, who goes on, Per Frandsen, I think, comes back. And an interesting arrival that kind of it becomes a bit of a pattern. Colin Hendry arrives as a sort of 35-year-old centre-back. And there's sort of, you know, one of the things that Sam Allardyce definitely does is he doesn't give up on people, does he?
No, that was one of the things with him. He always valued experience. He valued good players. And, you know, obviously they bring the experience, bring skill, bring a mindset to the club. You know, the young players look up to them. But he had the sort of ability to keep them going as well, because one of the things that he had picked up on a lot was he'd spent some time at Tampa Bay as a player. And from there, he picked up a lot of, this is the thing that we talk about Sam Allardyce being a long ball specialist, but he had an awful lot more from than that. And one of the things he had was, in terms of sports science, nutrition, training methods, things like that, he was absolutely light years ahead of a lot of people in that regard. And he'd picked it up from his stint in America. He was able to keep like players going on for longer than, you know, they might have otherwise gone on for.
Deck on that as well. That time he had at Tampa, he was picking up and observing almost like the sports science that it was to become. Because Tampa Bay, who he was playing for, was it the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the American football team that shared the same location as the soccer team? And I think it was Allardyce's interest in American football where he was able to kind of pick up on the data science and the nutrition and all those things that he would kind of, you know, would stick with him to bring back into the English game when he became a coach. Is that the connection?
I think so, yeah. It certainly did. When he was there, he sort of branched out and he saw the sort of things that were being done and he thought, oh my goodness, this is absolutely light years ahead of what we see in, you know, in football. I mean, obviously at the time we're talking about the late 70s here, where the idea of sports nutrition was still like a few pints after the game and a sick. I mean, he was way ahead of his time in that regard.
He was one of the first to use the Prozone technology as well, which I think Steve McLaren had been using and Man United had been using in some way, but certainly among the lower league clubs. I think Prozone is mostly used for sort of transfer scouting and bits and pieces, but he was using that much more for analysis of tactics, wasn't he?
Yeah, we mentioned Oldham in the last podcast I did, and they used that a lot as well. It was just sort of coming into its own then, and you know, he was certainly an advocate of it as well.
One of the great things about Allardyce, and whether he counts as long ball or direct, I think there's a pragmatism to his football, and that I think comes from this sort of approach. And it is quite interesting. I was reading about his what you called the Fantastic Four. You know, it's about stuff getting balls in the air and stuff. So there were things like he'd worked out that Bolton had to stop the opposition from scoring in 16 of their 38 games in order to avoid relegation. Bolton scored first, had a 70% chance of winning. Set pieces accounted for almost a third of all goals scored. In-swinging corners were more effective than out-swingers. If they outran their opposition, then they obviously, you know, that's not... none of this stuff is rocket science, but it's kind of... I think there was a level of pragmatism that then came to embody his football.
If you watch them, a lot of their goals, a lot of them come from sort of high-hanging, in open play, they come from high-hanging diagonal balls. It's not that often that you'd see them, well, I say not that often, but you did, but a lot of the time, they would take to the byline, but also they would like put high-hanging balls into the box for the... what they used to call the position of maximum opportunity, whatever. Mm. When you see him take corners or throw-ins, Okocha was the long throw expert for a long time, and they were a big team. They were always a big team. Bolton. I mean, you looked at Gary Speed, who's like 5'10", but later on, and he looked small in that team. So they'd have all of the centre backs or big strikers, and it'd all surround the keeper, and it would just be high hanging ball towards the keeper. The keeper's in no man's land a lot of the time,
But what I think we will come on to later is the revelation he had when he signed one of those other players in the shape of Fernando Hierro. And that's an interesting little story, that.
Yeah, and just before that, and picking up on your point previously, Graham, about Kevin Davis being the principal Bolton Wanderers player that comes into your head. For me, it's Kevin Nolan, and it's for the reasons that Dave just outlined. You know, he was an incredible physical presence on the football pitch, and sharp elbows, really difficult to play against, almost ugly to play against in terms of his physicality, but he could play as well. I think it was Allardyce's multi-layered brilliance, and I don't use that cheaply, because I'm not a massive fan of Allardyce, but I do respect he had lots of attributes, and what he was able to do was bring in players that had the guys to kind of read situations and feed off balls, like we're getting to talking about Yuri Juroc, like Jokiev and JJ Okocha, who Dex already referenced. Those players that had creativity just pouring out of them were able to read the situations when balls were plumped into Nolan and Davis, who were going to invariably win them in the air. And then you've got these creative players buzzing around to cause problems in the penalty box.
He was a very physical player, though. He was a very fit player, box-to-box midfielder. He had a lot about him. You know, he was a skillful player. He'd have fitted into one of those lead sides in the early 70s. Absolutely no problem whatsoever. He was, let's not beat around the bush. He was a cop-eye, and he hated Everton. So, you know, there are certain, my respect is grudging for him, but he drove that midfield with his physicality, with his ability as well. He reminded me in some ways of Joe Parkinson when he was at Everton. Similar kind of player who we loved, but obviously for the same reasons, Nolan, we didn't. There's a lovely story I actually mentioned to Jamie the other day. We played them in this match, and I think it was 99. We'd beaten three, and it was one of the 8 times Duncan Ferguson got sent off.
Not that season.
Although it seemed like it. What he got sent off for was he got sent off for punching Freddie Bobic off the ball. And he got in the dressing room, and Moyes absolutely coated him. He coated him in the press afterwards. He just really gave him stick. And Ferguson's justification was, "I'm really sorry, Gaffer. I thought it was that effing Nolan." Yeah, it's like, oh, that's all right then. It was Kevin Nolan you tried to it there. He went with Allardyce twice later on, didn't he? He went to Newcastle with him, and then he went to West Ham. And, you know, he did a great job from there as well. But, I mean, the first game he played for Newcastle, I think he got sent off for going in too fussed on Victor Anijibi.
Kevin Nolan, as you say, he did follow Sam Allardyce to Newcastle, and that was where there was... My favourite sort of Kevin Nolan moment is almost where... I mean, it could be the plot of a really dodgy sitcom. It's the one where Andy Carroll is in danger of falling off the straight and narrow, and the judge essentially spares him from prison, but he has to go and live with Kevin Nolan. So it's like a premise of your worst kind of sitcom.
Oh, someone is behaving badly.
Under what circumstance? and from what I remember, Kevin Nolan, I don't know, you know, I would think within the team is a fantastic influence. I'm not sure he was able to keep Andy Carroll particularly on the straight and narrow. But I think you get to, this is probably the thing about this Bolton side and this entire period. You have this, I think there is a paradox about them, that you have on the one hand this very pragmatic kind of football and this, you know, quite, I suppose, quite direct, quite long ball in many ways, but also you have some extraordinary flair players, some talent that you just wouldn't necessarily expect to be there. And I think throughout Allardyce's time across that period, he does bring in some extraordinary players.
Well, you did indeed. I mean, everyone remembers Okocha, but I think the first one really in that line was Jokiev. And that was kind of, I wouldn't say a marriage of convenience, maybe a symbiosis going on there, because Jokiev, he wasn't getting any game time. I'm not sure. I can't remember where he was before he went.
Yeah, Kaiserslautern.
Kaiserslautern, thank you very much. He wasn't getting any game time, and there was a World Cup coming up, and he wanted to make the squad. So basically, Allardyce went, oh, should we have a punt? And he went over there. And he said his backroom staff, they put a little video together, like a little, almost like a travel brochure for him to show him where Bolton was and, you know, what was around it and where the ground was and what the club was like and stuff like that. And they worked on him, and Jock Ayres said, yeah, I'm perfectly happy to do this. If you know, I mean, I need game time. You want someone with flair, and let's go. That was the beginning of a beautiful 3-year friendship for them.
It was such a random, it appeared such a random signing, but it then goes to become, as you say, it almost becomes the template as across the years you find that he keeps signing unlikely sort of showbiz players, whether that is Giannopoulos or Okocha, who of course is the standout. And I think what's really interesting about these players, and maybe they're not quite, I think maybe Kempo is probably my favourite example, Ivan Kempo, of a player. It just seems unlikely that they would emerge at Bolton. But not only do they sort of arrive, does he not? He manages to get them there. They thrive, and they seem the players seem to really enjoy being there.
Yeah, Kempo went to Bolton on loan, and Real Madrid were expecting him back, and he said, "No, I want to stay here. I'd rather stay in Bolton than live in Madrid." Which is, I'm not sure what went on there. I mean, I'm not being disrespectful to Bolton, the town, but you know, it's not the sort of place I think of taking a first date, shall we say? So I'm not sure exactly what went on there. But I mean, does the players remember his forwards and his midfielders? But also people like Bruno Engotti, you know, he'd won a Cupminers Cup medal. Piero, as we mentioned, he came along. He was a teammate of Campos. And he was the one, more than anyone, who changed Allardyce's style. And Allardyce admitted it himself. He actually said that when Piero came as a defender, but he moved him into midfield. And the reason he moved him into midfield, as a defensive midfielder, was because he could pass. And he said he could pass on a six, but his delivery was absolutely fantastic. And he said at that point, he said, I realised that with the players we've got, yeah, we will mix it up. We'll still have the long ball. We'll have the physical side of the game, but we don't have to do that all the time. We've got players here of genuine quality who can deliver passes. They've got skill. They've got pace. They've got the ability to find space. We think of Bolton as a Route 1 team, and then you look at some of the goals that they scored, and the intricate 8, 9, 10 passing moves was all one-touch stuff all around the box, and it's, you know, this is the year where that starts to take root.
There's a couple of key things in this, I think. The first one is that clearly Allardyce, with the reputation of long ball football, signing these incredibly creative players, Jock Ayres, JJ Okocha, Herrero, doesn't support the narrative that Allardyce is all about Route 1 football. He clearly has more about his game. And I think what Allardyce does exceptionally well is that he understands people. He's a football manager, but he understands people. And I think he has such a great relationship with his players. And that's something that he just has a natural gift for, that he's able to convince people like Yuri Djorkaeff to stick around in Bolton for a few years, for Ivan Kempo not to want to go back and, you know, enjoy the tapas in Madrid and, you know, stick with the chips and gravy in Bolton. Sam Allardyce deserves a lot of credit, one, for bringing in the type of players that supports a mixed style of football, which is maximising positions of opportunity, that phrase that Dex already used, but also he's able to just manage these players from multiple parts of the world. I mean, there's a season where having Bolton have like, I think 16 or 17 different nationalities in the dressing room. I mean, that takes some talent to manage that. That really is something special that managers do when you're managing people from those various cultures.
There's several teams you've talked about previously who, and we, in fact, the Howard Kendall's Everton, for example, extraordinarily young side. In this instance, Sam Allardyce is, does have young players there. He does have people coming. Kevin Nolan's a youngster who emerges through that side. But he finds a way of using the transfer market to bring in experienced pros to get them and actually pay over the odds in that market for people. But it maybe in terms of salary, I mean, he gets a lot of free transfers. He does a lot of clever business in that respect. But, you know, I was struck with, you know, a player that you'll know very well, Declan, in him signing Gary Speed. And
yes.
And he's, you know, by this stage, you know, I think Speed is well into his 30s, and he pays something like $750,000 for him. But it's, you know, everyone else had kind of thought that's not money well worth spent. But, you know, I don't think the one thing Sam Allardyce isn't looking for is resale value.
No, but with I mean, that wasn't a gamble at all with Gary Speed. I mean,
I could go on all night about Gary Speed. He was one of my favourite players ever. His ability, his all-round game, playing so many positions. He looked after himself. He kept himself fit. He was very keen on the nutritional side himself and the sports science. He was a model pro, basically. And he was one of Allardyce's favourite players, one of his favourite signings. He said that. And he said one of the things that he loved about him was his influence on the younger players. And he'd say if, you know, he saw younger players slacking, he would outright tell them, no, don't do this. You know, you let yourself down. You let the club down. And he was just a fantastic player. I loved him to bits. Not to say that Allardyce didn't have duds in this policy. I mean, he had one or two. When he sold Ricketts, I think there was a guy he brought in on loan, Pierre-Yves André or something like that, who didn't pull any trees off. There was a guy called Mario Jardel, Brazilian, they brought in. They had like high hopes of him, and that didn't really work out. Ibrahim Bar, the Bar, I don't think he would exactly pulled up any trees either. I mean, he looked like one, but he didn't really pull up any. So yeah, but in the main, he did always praise his heads of recruitment as well, because they'd go out and find these players for him. And, you know, so Allardyce had worked with them, and most of the time, it turned out really well for them.
It shouldn't go unmentioned. Allardyce did make a lot of signings. I mean, he's averaging, other than the first season when they get into the Premier League and he trusts what he's got, after that, when the Premier League money is rolling in, Allardyce is, you know, averaging 8, 9, 10 players coming in every season. And as Dex mentioned, there were a few duds in, you know, in the same season they bought Gary Speed in, they also brought in Les Ferdinand, who was similar age. And that did work out. There was another one who was let go towards the end of that season. So he is casting the net quite wide in terms of the players he's bringing in, but he is bringing in quality. And I think there is some significance that may lead into this at the point of when Allardyce gets to that point in time where he feels that the board aren't backing in terms of the transfer market. And it could be because he is just routinely buying new players at every single transfer window.
I think what is interesting around this, and we've sort of touched on it, is there's this great squad of players that he's assembling. And over a period it doesn't take long for Bolton to establish themselves. So in those first couple of years in the Premier League, it's a bit of a dash against a bit of a struggle to survive. They're in a couple of relegation battles. But from that moment on, it's a pretty successful side, isn't it?
Yeah, the first couple of seasons, they were sort of bumbling about down the bottom end. But then when they brought Stelios in, around about that time, that's when they really started to take off. And that's when he really started to challenge. And at the same time, I think probably about that time was about the time they brought Neil Hadjidjian. When we talk about man management, there's the prime example of man management. One man disaster area there, quite frankly.
I think this is the best example of Sam Allardyce as a Mac says his man management skills. I think you're absolutely right, Deck. I mean, you know, El Hadjidjian has left his mark literally on some people. And if you look at his career, he seldom stays at a football club beyond two seasons. With Allardyce, he stays at Bolton for four seasons, which is something he doesn't do at any other football club. The closer he comes to doing that is when he's with Blackburn Rovers and he stays for 2.5 seasons. It coincides with the same 2.5 seasons that Sam Allardyce is at Blackburn Rovers. So Sam Allardyce is clearly the only football manager that has had El Hadjidjian, and he's been able to train this beast and get the best out of him, because there's a divisive character if ever we've met one.
Yeah, if I'm gonna go Nolan, I admire
this fella.
Nah. the serial expectorator, as we called him.
Yeah.
Spit the dog. Do you know, I've got some notes written down here, right, about when players came in. I can't even read my own writing now, but the one word I can read from LSG is spit. But yeah, Allardyce also caught him on the straight and narrow. He said he was taking him to a behavioural psychologist or something to stop him from spitting on people, and also to stop him. Yeah, he liked driving without a license as well for some bizarre reason. I think he had a few motor offences throughout his career.
But this is the quality of Allardyce that you shouldn't really overlook. I mean, the fact that he's invested in this individual, not just as he invested as a player star. He's finding ways to tap into the psychology of this individual. And as you said, Dec, he pushed him towards a psychologist to help this guy, not just on the football field, but off the football field as well, to become a better person. You know, maybe some other life has got something to do with leading him onto the straight and narrow and becoming a successful human being. Who knows?
It's interesting. So after those first couple of slightly backs the wall kind of seasons, Bolton set into a groove, which is to fundamentally finish eighth or thereabouts in the Premier League. They actually, I suppose, the natural target for Bolton, once you've established some kind of solidity and a sense of fitting into the Premier League, is Europe, isn't it? And I suppose that then becomes the ambition for Bolton, is can they make it into Europe?
Yeah, in those four seasons, they were knocking on the door. They finished 8th, 6th, 8th, and 7th. And obviously that getting into Europe at that time was the holy grail. And he was trying to build a squad that he could have a credible European campaign. And that's obviously where changing his style helped as well, because obviously you can play long ball, you can play physical, but it's not necessarily going to get you through a European campaign.
So, Jamie, they do make it into Europe, don't they?
They do, and it's the UEFA Cup, Graham, not the Europa League at the time, and it's the UEFA Cup, where it's doing one of its, like, UEFA have decided to shake it up and change the way that the group stage works. And bizarrely, they are in a group of 5 teams when they go into Europe for their first time, and they play all 4 teams once, 2 at home and 2 away. And the top 3 from the group will qualify to the next stage. That is the structure of this particular UEFA Cup.
An obvious format. And they do okay there, don't they?
Yeah, they qualify in 3rd place. So they play Seville. They draw with Seville. And Seville go on and win it. But Seville always go on and win it. They've got the Portuguese sides, Guimarães, which they draw as well. They play against Sixtas from Turkey. And they finish 3rd in the group. And they go on, they qualify for the round of 32. That quality round that just rolls off the tongue. The round of 32. Which we can look forward to in the next edition of the World Cup. There will be a round of 32.
Every tournament should have a 32.
They unfortunately draw Olympique Marseille. At the time, they're a pretty tidy Marseille team. I think they've got Ribéry playing for them, as well as Nasri, who went to Arsenal and Manchester City. They get a credible draw in the first game, and then in the second leg, they take a lead. But unfortunately, Marseille, you need the 2 away goals to qualify for the following round, which is the round of 16. They go, and Bolton go out by the old goal against Olympique Marseille, who are obviously one of the big hitters. So it's a credible run for Bolton to get to the last 32. But what I think it does, it leaves a really sweet taste in Allardyce's mouth, and I think he fancies this. He wants European football for Bolton Wanderers on a season-by-season basis, and I think his eyes are looking even bigger prizes.
Yes, he doesn't lack ambition at this stage. And I suppose there is, Sam Allardyce is, I guess on the one hand, a divisive football figure in football. And I think his legacy is to, you know, and certainly if you look back at his career now, he is known as a Red Adair relegation firefighting specialist on the grounds that I think until very, very recently, I think his record has finally gone now, never having taken anyone down. But that was kind of what he was known for, wasn't it? Is that he would never take a team down. He took Leeds Town as well, actually, last year. But, you know, a lot of his, that's kind of what his reputation has become over years and years. But whilst at Bolton, whilst up on the stars in its ascendancy, I think that's the time where he thinks he can do more. And of course, one of the reasons probably people think about his ability to keep sides up rather than to win things is that he hasn't won anything.
No, he hasn't with anyone. He got Notts County. You could count Notts County. He won a league title with Notts County in the lower leagues that got him promotion. He won a promotion, as we talk about, with Bolton here through the playoffs. And he also did the same with West Ham United. But yeah, in terms of physical trophies at top level, it has escaped him. And I think you're right, Graham. I think what Allardyce believes in himself is probably not reflected generally to how people perceive him. I think I remember him saying that at one point in his career, he was definitely good enough to go and manage Real Madrid. And I don't think it was a tongue-in-cheek comment. I think he generally had a high opinion of himself. And I think through Bolton Wanderers, he deserves to think that way, because in the 06-07 season, Bolton Wanderers are flying high. Going into January, the new year of the 2006-2007 season, Bolton Wanderers are sitting third on 39 points. You know, they're in an armchair with Manchester United, Chelsea and Liverpool for the title. And I think Allardyce is genuinely believing that Bolton Wanderers can go and qualify in the top four places of the Premier League for the Champions League.
I think before we get on to that, what we should meant the nearest they did get to a trophy at Bolton, which is the League Cup, or what was it called in those days, with the Wellington, the Carling, I'm not sure now.
They do successfully make their way to, Bolton make their way to the Carling Cup final, as it was, at the Millennium Stadium. This is their moment of opportunity. They're playing against Middlesbrough, so you have two sides who unfamiliar. It's been a long time since Bolton have a rich heritage, but they won anything for many a year, and Middlesbrough too. So we get this final at the Millennium Stadium, and it's a Bolton are a bit up against. They have a pretty disastrous start in that game, don't they?
Yeah, they let two goals in very early on. In fact, I think if I recall correctly, all three of the goals came quite early. The goal that Davis clawed back for him, that was also quite early on as well. But I think from there, Bolton were the better side, and I think they should have won that. It was just that I think that conceding those two early goals was basically finished them for that match, unfortunately.
And when I did my research on this, I read something which described the game having been stolen by Mike Riley. This wasn't an impartial rule, but certainly they didn't get the rub of the green of the decisions on the day and the luck on the day. There's a bit of controversy about Bello Zenden's two-touch penalty. He slips as he takes the penalty and gets a double kick at it as it goes in. And then Bolton, a bit unlucky not to get a penalty of their own. They do get a bit of luck.
Yeah, it is fair to say that Allardyce never really forgave Mike Riley for that.
There's a bit of a sliding doors moment as well with this, because this would have been the first time Bolton Wanderers would have gone on and won this football match and won a trophy. Not only would we be talking about Sam Allardyce in a different light, they would have gone into Europe that season, which I think would have been their first season before they qualified through the Premier League, which is still a massive achievement. And Middlesbrough actually go on all the way to the final, where they lose to Seville, as everyone does. There could have been an opportunity for Sam Allardyce to take this incredible Bolton team, which was absolutely flooded with his stars at the time, into European competition, where I think they probably would have done fairly well in that edition of the UEFA Cup.
Well, it's a real sliding doors moment, of course, because who was the Middlesbrough manager at the time?
Yes, it was Mr. Southgate.
So, you know,
the parallels are spooky.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We talk about that final, and they are unlucky. They they hit the post, have a number of chances in that game. And I do think it does sort of colour the memory. You know, I think it's a particularly harsh, I've not really brought it up, but I think it's a harsh thing to throw at or label at Sam Allardyce for not having won stuff. I don't think he's necessarily had those opportunities. And had Bolton won that tournament, I think that won that cup, it could have been a very different legacy to this. But that cup run, arguably the more memorable game was the semi-final, wasn't it? And it's perhaps more memorable because it's part of our opportunity to have a love in for JJ Okocha.
Bolton win the first leg 5-2. Okocha scores two absolutely blinding free kicks, and it was just typical of the player he was. I mean, he wasn't an out-and-out goal scorer. And he didn't score that. It's surprising to see how many he actually didn't score, but in terms of his ability, oh my goodness. I mean, he is the player that everyone remembers. It's just what he could do. He just had ability and bags, just pace. He was actually quite small for an Allardyce player, which is a little bit sort of against the grain, it like. But, I mean, Allardyce, even to this day, he just absolutely rates him as one of the greatest players he ever signed. And quite rightly, because he was a real a showman, an entertainer. I mean, he got involved in the Route 1 stuff as well. As I said, I mentioned earlier, he was actually their long throw expert as well. So he had that to his game. Obviously, him being one of the smaller guy, he's the guy who's like pumped in the throw for the big guys that head down and put on the back of the net. But yeah, absolutely fantastic player. Well, that song they had there, So Good They Named Him Twice, JJ, JJ, So Good They Named Him Twice, blah, blah. It's a bit of a shame what happened towards the end. They'd made him captain. And then I think he sort of made it clear in his final year that he was off to Qatar. So they sort of stripped the captaincy off him, and then he didn't get many games after that, which, you know, was a bit of a shame. But he is absolutely well remembered. I think the Bolton fans have actually voted him the greatest player that they ever had, which speaks volumes.
Yeah, just to kind of piggyback on the bandwagon of Wax Luton about JJ Okocha, he inspired the Brazilian Ronaldo, he inspired the Portuguese Ronaldo with just some of his incredible play. Some of the kind of the step overs that he was bringing into his game have been replicated by so many different players. Loads of people remember him, and Ray Parler probably remembers him more than anyone else when he does that ridiculous Aussie Idealist rainbow crip kick over his head. I mean, he's doing this on the football pitch. But what was brilliant about JJ Okocha is that he was given freedom on the football pitch by Sam Allardyce. Now, this is, again, I think, credit to Sam Allardyce in terms of what he wants to get the best out of his players. So he's formed a partnership with Jurgen Djurgaev, but he's been given freedom to do whatever he wants on the football pitch, whereby Allardyce's teams are generally about structure and discipline and positions of maximum opportunity and playing the ball in certain areas. JJ Okocha's got a free pass. And, you know, there's not many players that I can think of that have played in the Premier League that get that free pass. You know, you're looking at players like Dennis Bergkamp, Eric Cantona, and if you go beyond that, you're looking at players like Lionel Messi. So JJ Okocha is in that bracket in terms of the qualities that he brings to a football team. And fair play to Allardyce for allowing him to have that freedom. But yeah, the free kick, one of those free kicks for him against Aston Villa in the semi-final is ridiculous because he's at an angle where it's every single day of the week. It's a right footer to bend around the right-hand side of the wall to curl it into the left-hand side of where the goalkeeper's standing. But no, he does the absolute opposite. It's outside of the foot job on the near post. It's absolutely incredible. The technique to pull that off.
The technique and the pace of it as well. I mean, the pace it goes in at. I mean, there's obviously a surprise factor. No one's expecting it because it is insane to bend it that way around. But it is one of the greatest free kicks there is. I mean, you're right, Jeremy. He did. You know, he was given a free pass on the one end. He was the person they would create. But he did sort of fit in. He kind of, you know, you wouldn't have become captain without buying into the methods. He did put a shift in. He's also, again, a typical Allardyce signing. You know, he was 28, taking a chance. You know, they pay decent money for him. I think he was 10 million or so. But again, it's kind of a signing when other clubs are maybe not looking towards that kind of profile of player. They're maybe looking towards a younger player or someone they can keep some resale value on. And as Dex says, you talk to any Bolton fan, that's they probably can't believe they had that moment of having him play for him. He was just an unbelievable player. We have talked about signings, Sam Allardyce. We should say, I suppose, the other thing, and there's never been, controversy has followed Sam Allardyce around, not least when he finally got his dream of becoming the England manager. But even before this, even in the Bolton days, he does become the centre of some allegations in football around the time. And it's fair to say that the Panorama programme, which is focused around him and of his son, who's an agent at the time, this isn't the only investigation going on about potential regularities in football and in transfers. But there is, I guess, a bit of a cloud on the horizon there, Jamie.
I think Allardyce is, like many of us, he likes to take care of his future financially. He likes the finer things in life. So, you know, there have been allegations generally linked around agents and how players have been bought. And that's what Panorama was trying to expose. And we probably should stress that there were no charges brought against Sam Allardyce, but his son, it was the suggestion that was potentially taking, may have been, you know, taking a backhander potentially from an agent in order to service players going into the hands of Sam Allardyce, who obviously would operate Bolton. And, you know, and this allegation followed him around. Clinton Morrison later at West Ham also came out and said that he's been pushed towards a particular agent that had links with Sam Allardyce. But we should stress that, you know, nothing's been proven. But it's strange with Sam Allardyce, you've got this kind of reputation of, you know, maybe he's a bit dodgy, but also he plays long ball football. When the reality is, and the facts are, that neither of those are actually true, but they do seem to follow him around.
I mean, the curious thing about that Panorama documentary was he actually outright said to the undercover reporter, "No, I'm not going to say that. No, that's not what we do. 30 years ago, perhaps, but no, that's just wrong. It's not happening." And it's curious that he actually said, "No, I'm not doing that." And he was hung for not doing it, strangely.
Well, it's similar with the England situation as well. I mean, his, you know, that whole thing that I think it was the Daily Telegraph kind of had him on as well. He actually didn't do anything wrong. There was nothing he did that you could say was illegal. But again, it's the stigma that's attached to it. And it's what follows in terms of like how he's almost played out in kangaroo courts afterwards.
There was an awful lot of that about. I have a long-standing friend who was a player liaison officer for a Premiership club who I won't mention. It's not Everton. And he came out with some, he can tell you some stories, let's say. not just about player behaviour, but also the shenanigans surrounding agents. So, I mean, I say that for no other reason than to say, it's always been there and it's rife, and but you know, without actually labelling people, as my lawyers have advised me not to, it's not unusual, as Tom Jones might say.
I tell you what is unusual: at his time at Bolton, when he did get them promoted into the Premier League, he was given a 10-year contract. Now that's unprecedented. I can't find any manager through my research that has been offered a contract at that length. We're talking some of the established coaches like, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson and Arsene Wenger and Pep Guardiola. I mean, the only one I could find is probably the one that you two guys know, and that's the Alan Pardew 8-year contract at Newcastle United.
But unlike Pardew, Allardyce only had the 1-year buyout.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know what? And Allardyce makes a point of, even now, on his own podcast, No Tippy Tappy Football, I mean, that tells you everything, right? He spoke about that 10-year contract, and he made a point of saying, yeah, but there was only a 1-year buyout. So again, you can see his head is thinking, finance, finance, finance. And it's a natural thing to do. You want to get paid. And if you're going to be bought out of your contract, you want to make sure you're going to be covered.
We should point out, of course, that Sam Allardyce left with a 100% record as England manager. Quite impressive, isn't it?
He has the unfortunate statistic of being the shortest ever full-time England manager and also the shortest ever Premier League manager. His 30 days at Leeds last season, which I think is super unfortunate. Because he was brought in last minute to try and save a team that had already pretty much been relegated, and he was never going to continue in that role afterwards. So I think Allardyce again is a bit unfortunate to have and carry those two pretty unimpressive statistics around with him.
You've touched on this, Jamie. There was definitely an ambition of Sam Allardyce, and this is where it starts to end and go wrong at Bolton, or at least the partnership ends, because Bolton don't match his ambitions. Is that right?
There's two ways of looking at this, really. I mean, they did sign Neco and Elka, as you mentioned. I think he was £8 million, and he was could have taken some next level. And let's back to Liverpool about Elka for a moment, because I think he scored 23, and he was a fantastic striker. He really was. You look at those 20s. I watched the things, just all 23 goals he scored. I think three of them were close range. Everything else was absolutely top draw. Mm. Most of them were just off the shoulder defender, make the run, slant it across the keeper, and in. And at that, I think he was one of the best I've ever seen at doing that. Just taking it away from the last defender, squaring up the keeper, slotting it past him. Brilliant. Absolutely fantastic player. We talked about Allardyce's man management. He had a bit of a reputation in Elka for being stroppy. Not to put too fine a point on it. And he carried that reputation around with him at Arsenal. He carried it around with him at Liverpool when he was there, to Chelsea to a certain degree afterwards. But at Bolton, Allardyce said, I absolutely no problems with him whatsoever. Model professional, put in the hard yards. Fantastic player, really was. But yeah, I mean, he was part of the building process. But I think what had happened was, I think they got round Christmas and they'd got 39 points already. So obviously they weren't going to get relegated. They were halfway through the season. And he's thinking, we probably need 20-something points. I guess maybe he said 23 or 28. We need that for Champions League. And he'd identified three players. He said, the squad was running on fumes. He was playing pretty much the same 11 players week in, week out. They were getting the results. They just won the last five, but they were running on fumes. And he was thinking, okay, I can get these three players. I can get them for around £6 million. And he said to the board, give me the money for this, £6 million, get these three players. I'll get you Champions League football. And the board turned around and said, no, we don't want Champions League football, which is an astonishing thing to say, because it's the gateway to Untold Bridge. It's the holy grail. When you think about it, I mean, it's a club, but you're talking a club that's surviving on 20,000 attendances every week. They've got a lot of debt to service with that stadium. They may get more punters in, but not that many more, really, from the surrounding area. I think that they were just thinking, yeah, we can just pootle along, get cut runs, do okay in the league, make money from that turnover on player transfers. Yeah, we'll do all right here. We don't need any of that Champions League nonsense. That really boiled his pay, frankly. He just said, well, the club, it's not matching my ambition. That's it. I've had enough.
I'm a little torn on this. I kind of feel that Allardyce, as an individual, with all his qualities, sometimes suffers some kind of delusion. I think he shapes a truth around the facts that fits what he wants to believe. So you're absolutely right, Dick. You know, Bolton was secure in the Premier League at this particular point. They were third or fourth. Champions League is a brilliant ambition, and I completely commend what Allardyce is thinking right now. And his logic stacks up. Best thing is now in January, whilst we can, secure Champions League football, and the rest is history for Bolton Wanderers in terms of what they can achieve from that. This is where I have my doubts. Whether the board said we don't want Champions League football, whether that's what Allardyce heard. As we've mentioned, Allardyce has signed a lot of footballers in his time at Bolton Wanderers. He's bringing in multiple players per transfer window. And maybe they just thought, we need to step back from this. I have my doubts in terms of Allardyce's view in terms of whether Bolton Wanderers generally didn't want Champions League football, whether Allardyce is just kind of framed that way that, to kind of suit his end goal, which is to say, you don't fit my ambitions, I'm off.
I think one of the that might give us a clue to that is after he left when they signed El Manda. And I think he was about 15 million or something. So there's not to say there wasn't money there and there wasn't ambition there, that they'd sign a player like that after he'd gone. Strangely, it became a source of self-fulfilling prophecy that he didn't do, El Manda didn't do that well. And the, I guess, kind of one of the catalysts that started a debt spiral that eventually consumed him.
It's ironic, I suppose. I mean, actually, it kind of works. It sort of works out better for Bolton than just Sam Allardyce. Sam Allardyce joins Newcastle. It's not a particularly successful stint as manager. He's eventually replaced by Kevin Keegan. I think that's where you start to see, you know, that legacy of the type of football that he plays or is viewed as playing, perhaps working against him. He was in the frame for the, he was offered the Man City job, or he was in the frame of the man of taking the Man City job after Stuart Pearce left in 07. So things could have turned out differently. You know, he continues to have, you know, a very successful career as a manager. Blackburn he does very well at, but never gets that kind of, until he gets his short-lived England job, he never gets that position he really, really craves of a Champions League team.
Basically was the high watermark for him. He went to Newcastle, similar story again when Freddie Sheppard came in. He's saying, well, the club doesn't match my ambition. Bolton, I can't remember, but he basically he said the same kind of thing. And that's where he became, his ambition then was, I'm the sheriff who'll come in and save you from relegation. And that's when that phase of his career started, the troubleshooter. And that's when we got him, unfortunately.
Just before that misery day, just on the Blackburn thing, is I think this is where reputation has actually ruled the roost, because Allardyce was there, I think, before the Vinkies came in. He's done, as you mentioned, he'd done quite well with Blackburn. He kind of kept them mid-table. They'd been out of the Premier League since winning it. They got back in and he'd stabilised them in the Premier League. And I think the Vinkies came in and decided he's not our man. And it's potentially they've decided that because they, you know, they've learned from the reputation that Allardyce plays this particular style of football, which I think we're saying now is not accurate. And maybe on the reputation, they decided to replace him. I can't remember they replaced him with somebody who hadn't really, for the life of me, I can't remember.
You're absolutely right. He's
Steve Keane.
Steve Keane, yes.
Yeah. So they've replaced him with Steve Keane, who had been an assistant coach up until that point, and then has really done nothing in terms of management. So, you know, Allardyce was replaced by, with all of his experience, replaced with somebody with, you know, with potential but no experience really in terms of managing football teams.
Absolutely. And Bolton, Allardyce's assistant, Sammy Lee, has a short reign in charge. But Gary Megson comes in. Owen Coyle comes in afterwards. It's not, they never, Bolton themselves never touch that level of success again, but they do stay in the Premier League for a few years to come. I think they go down in 2012, and it's not a particularly happy story for Bolton over the past decade or so. Although they are seemingly riding high and going to finish above us in the current league, and they absolutely hammered us on the TV. But just the 5-0. Just the 5-0. Things definitely looking up for them. So I had forgotten.
It just so, before that, yeah, Everton. It'd be good to get Dex's take on Sam Allardyce and Everton manager.
It's fair to say he would have come in with a tough hand, wouldn't he?
Not really. The team weren't doing that badly. They were 13th when he came in. They were suffering from expectation, really. I mean, we'd had some. He succeeded Koeman. Mm. Who's going to be the new messiah. And after we got a good kicking at home against Arsenal, we'd suddenly decided he's not the messiah, he's a very naughty boy. He was, oh goodness, what a dire time that was. But yeah, he came in and we just went, oh no. I think Unsworth had been caretaker for a bit, and we just thought, no, please, just leave Unsworth in place. Don't bring him. He got us to eighth, which, yeah, now I kill for that kind of mediocrity. I'd be quite happy with that. But, oh, God, it was awful. It was just dreadful, and he didn't take to us. We didn't take to him. The one thing I do have sympathy with him with is he, whether this is delusion or not from him, but he basically was promised things at Everton, and then obviously he got sacked after 6 months, and he puts that down entirely to politics from above. And I, knowing what was happening at Everton at the time with Mashiri and Ken Wright, particularly Ken Wright, I can completely concur with that. I'm not saying he was the right man for us. I'm not saying that the sacking wasn't the right decision. But my goodness, there's some politics going on there.
Definitely. So win ratio of 38.3, bettered by Carlo Ancelotti, who did have some sums, and Marco Silva. So there you go, since then.
Well, he's doing all right now, isn't he, Marco Silva, if you're going back.
Sometimes it's not the manager, it's the situation, isn't it?
Well, that's Everton for you.
Excellent. Okay, so we should get to ranking this side. As a reminder, we have 5 categories of greatness, from all-time greats up at the top through to true greats to touch of greatness, our middle-of-the-road category, followed by edge of greatness, and our blinkered greats down below. Jamie, where do you want to go with Sam Allardyce's Bolton?
Well, I start off with a couple of things that are probably worth knowing. So, Beck mentioned when they finished in the top 8 for 4 seasons in a row in the Premier League. Now, since the year 2000, so almost 25 years ago, outside the top 6, Manchester United, Manchester City, Arsenal, Liverpool, and Tottenham and Chelsea, only 3 clubs have ever managed that, 4 seasons consecutively finishing the top 8 in the Premier League. That kind of shows you how difficult it is. Southampton being one of them, and David Moyes' Everton consistently finishing the top 8, I think for 7 or 8 seasons in the early 2000s. So what Sam Allardyce has done with Bolton in that 4-year period is something that is incredibly difficult to do in the Premier League if you're not inside the top 6. Which is changing every season. He's also the Premier League, this Manager of the Month thing award, right? Mm-hmm. And I know we should have got our bottom wonders, but Sam Allardyce is intrinsically linked into the success of this particular team. So Allardyce has won the Manager of the Month award 4 times when he was with this particular Bolton team. Alex Ferguson has won most of 27, but Allardyce is equal 10th with Bobby Robson. Only, you know, David Moyes, Jurgen Klopp, Pep Guardiola, Arsene Wenger and are above him in that particular list. That's a pretty impressive list, actually. And again, that lends credibility to the qualities of his manager. However, with this Bolton team, he punches above his weight. He showcases his ambition, and the club doesn't reach his ambition. So I think this is a classic tale of a football team, Bolton Wanderers, for this particular period, that have gone to the edge of greatness and they've not been able to go beyond the precipice of that edge.
Slim, where would you go?
This just takes me back to the Oldham episode we did. There's a lot of similarities in there. You've got I wouldn't say an unfashionable club, because Bolton had a lot more history than Oldham did. I mean, it reached the FA Cup final 7 times. Won it 4, I think, including the White Horse final, which is right, I never mentioned that, actually.
Oh, yeah, 1923, wasn't it? Good shot.
1923, yeah.
Yeah, great
shot. First one at Wembley, yeah. Yeah. They've been involved in. So, yeah, they did have tradition, they had history. What they didn't have, obviously, in the modern day game was a source of attachment and following the Giants do. I mean, just an accident's geography, really, being stuck between nearer to Manchester and Liverpool, I guess, but in that sort of hinterland. Yeah, it's a tricky one. I mean, as Jamie said, they really, really did punch above their weight, and that's testament to Allardyce's man management skills, his persuasiveness, what he was trying to create at that club, the camaraderie he got going, the techniques he had, the science he applied, you know, all that comes into it. Weighed against that, you've got to look at the fact that they had consistently high Premier League placings for a few seasons, but in the end they won nothing, absolutely nothing. So with that, I guess we're in the edge of greatness territory with them. had the dice fall in a different way, had, you know, if Ibaladice is right and they had Mesh's ambition, you know, we'll never know, but maybe they would have gone on and tracked the glass ceiling into the top four and become European stalwarts. Who knows? But, well, they didn't, so a directness man.
I want to find a different gas freezer to mix and spice things up. I think you can make a case for our occasionally used, not necessarily great, but without them, we wouldn't be where we are today, because they were very. Without them, would you have had Stoke City? I don't know. Would you have had that? Can they do it on a rainy night in Stoke? I think that's Sam Allardyce's legacy. I think the only thing you can say is that I think they did. He did Tony Pulis Stoke better than Tony Pulis Stoke did it, and he did it with more showbiz. I think you can even argue Blinkered Greats on this, only in as much as it is the stars of this team outweigh their overall achievements. So, you know, players like Okocha, like Jokaev, like these players who lift a very ordinary side, and everyone remembers these real, you know, Campo and Hierro, these Real Madrid players coming and playing at Bolton. It's just an incredible thing. I think that adds a certain something to the romance of this side. But ultimately, they did get qualified for Europe, which is actually an incredible achievement for a side like Bolton, or where they had come from. And I think you can't go any higher than that. As you say, the definition of edge of greatness is getting to a final and it not falling for you that day. And whether Sam Allardyce was hard done by or not, I think there's no other way of viewing it. Sam Allardyce's Bolton Wanderers, edge of greatness.
You're disappointed that you couldn't argue that Deck and I just nailed it, and we kind of left you hanging that there's no way you can go with that. You just have to agree.
I don't like to agree, but I have to. I have to on that one. I certainly couldn't put it higher. And lower seemed harsh. Lower seemed harsh. Deck, thanks for your time on this one.
Thank you very much, guys. Pleasure to be here again.
I hope it didn't involve too many bad Sam Allardyce memories from your Everton. Everton yesterday.
You can never have too many bad Sam Allardyce memories. To be honest, I'm more traumatised by looking at Kevin Nolan and seeing how good he was.
Kevin Nolan, what a star. Jamie, thank you as ever.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking Bolton Wanderers. I've actually developed an appreciation for Sam Allardyce. And thank you, Declan, for your brilliant Northwest correspondence. You are our Northwest expert as we grow this thing. We look forward to the likes of Stockport County and Tranmere Rovers, and who knows, maybe even Liverpool one day.
Ooh, that's stretching it a bit. Let's do City 67, something like that, because you know that can show me age.
Definitely so. So as a quick reminder, you can see a list of all the clubs that we have covered on this podcast and our slightly erratic ranking of them. We'll have a podcast in a few weeks' time where we have our promotion and relegation special. I know Jamie is looking forward to writing some of our ranking wrongs. But you can catch up with all those, and you can see all of those at our website, which is... Jamie, remind me, it's thegreatestteam.com.
You've got it. You don't need any reminding. You're there.
Excellent. So within that, you can find all the clubs that we've done, links to the various podcasts, and our fantastic starting 11s for some of the great sides. A quick reminder, of course, if you have enjoyed the podcast, please tell your friends, please follow, please subscribe, anything to get our name about. We will see you then.